Okay, first, I just want to have a little public address for the people at home. Scott's network, his internet network, is a little slow. So he's an impeccable editor. And so you probably won't hear it as bad as it is in real time. But if it sounds like we're no longer friends and we're just kind of like begrudgingly doing this podcast, it's because there's a little delay in our tracks. Yeah. So it just sounds like we're having an awkward first conversation.
We may not be friends when this is over. This episode might do it.
Yeah, this might be the end. We should have did War. Why Can't We Be Friends on this episode?
When you dine out alone
in a public place,
everyone is alarmed. They've all dialed on 911 in case they're about to be harmed. When the police arrive,
if you're taken alive,
that's when the real nightmare begins. Should have filled up that restaurant booth instead with border dogs and friends.
So Mike, Birkenstocks are back in a big way.
Oh, yeah.
They're back in a big way. Even Bedazzled. I saw a pair with some gems on them. And I kind of think it's our fault for talking about the Grateful Dead. So you saw something today that I don't even know what I'm looking at. We may be the first people to talk about it.
We're not the first people because I just saw it on the internet. And supposedly some radio station named The Wolf is the only one with like a reputable article on the internet. And it's like their website is like 1972thewolf.com. So no one would take it seriously, but supposedly someone posted a picture of maybe a sign or even maybe a future pizza box from Pizza Hut that has Cheez-It branding on it, and it's some sort of Cheez-It pizza, which is like, it looks like on the outside it looks like a giant Cheez-It with stuffed in with cheese and a hand is dipping it into sauce. So I imagine some kind of like a mozzarella stick type thing, but made with Cheez-Its. And even the article on The Wolf says they aren't 100% positive it's real. But it seems to be real because there's like a Reddit thread about it, and there's like, you know, the sign looks pretty real. It doesn't look photoshopped or anything like that. And so apparently this might be testing right now, and who knows if it'll hit the streets. I am a weird person who hates Cheez-Its, but I love shit like this though. So I am definitely going to be a day one sampler of the Pizza Hut Cheez-It pizza for sure.
I feel like lately the internet has kind of tripped over its own feet with being able to generate fakes, like because like the obvious plant dude, that kind of trick is what's in right now to be really so stupid that it's very clear that you've made a shit post and that it's not a real thing. So if this is a fake, it's really artful. It's such an odd idea and very well handled and perfect. If someone faked this, I love it. I love that you've did this because you can't possibly have had a reason to do it. There's no punchline to it whatsoever, but it's a giant cheese in it. It almost looks like it has sour, like cream cheese in the middle or something. And but you can fake a Cheez-It flavor pretty good at home. Like you can literally just throw a piece of cheese in your microwave or something and let it go, and when you pull it out, it's a Cheez-It. So this could be a slam dunk. You know, like if you make something that tastes like a Cheez-It but it's gigantic, I love Cheez-Its, so I'm super into this. Hollywood chat, Mike, I don't know. I sent you a link to this. I don't know if you read it, but Eva Longoria, Hollywood's Eva Longoria is going to make a movie about the Flamin' Hot Cheeto, a full length movie about the Flamin' Hot Cheeto.
A bunch of people sent it to me and I feel like it's like when they said, oh, well, they're going to make a Battleship movie, and they actually ended up making a Battleship movie, but they were talking about making a Battleship movie for decades. So once this actually gets a little more in motion and there's some wheels turning, I'll maybe read up about it. But until then, I'll just keep it as some bullshit.
I'm going to read you the synopsis because I can't believe this is real. So I didn't know any of this. Do you know anything about Flamin' Hot Cheetos?
Like other than didn't like the janitor invent them? I know the story of the Flamin' Hot Cheetos. I don't need to read the article.
So the Richard Montañez, a Cucamonga, Rancho Cucamonga janitor, just like grabbed a bag of remainders, you know, like the corn puffs that they didn't put any cheese on. He was like, I got an idea. I'm going to cover them in blazing hot chili powder because that reminds me of something called elotes.
Yeah, that's just basically corn with mayonnaise on it and cheese and
spicy chili powder. Right. Oh, I've had that.
Yeah.
He thought it was good and he pitched it to the, she just went to the CEO. Janitor just walks in the CEO and says, I got an idea. Like, here's something very spicy. And like that worked, and it became like the biggest snack in the world for a few minutes. And then he became an executive at PepsiCo, and now he goes around giving. That's one lucky break. Like, he made one snack.
Yeah.
They don't make you an executive because you had one good idea. Like, you came into work one day, like, hey, you know what would taste good is chili powder. We'll put you in the fucking White House, bro. Like, you need to get moved straight to the top. Like, he is giving he's giving like TED Talks and shit. Like, what is the nature of that talk? He's got about 3 minutes worth of material. What does he say on stage the whole time? So I like, this is, it's almost such a cliched story. Like, that this guy, this is like an 80s movie. Like, the guy rose to the top because he had this one cool idea and became an executive just sitting in like some sleek office with his shoes on the desk. Fuck that. There's no way that this is even, I don't even believe that the story is real.
No, it's been so long since I heard it, but I feel like he came up with that idea like fucking years ago when they were like, no, you're a moron. And then like after a while, they were like, we'll try it. And now obviously it's a huge empire, but yeah, in the end, it's not like that Michael Keaton McDonald's Ray Kroc movie, because that guy had like a storied history of being a piece of shit. this is a pretty quick, you know, this would be a good like half an hour kind of made for TV thing, but yeah. I don't know about a whole movie.
Also, he didn't invent like super spicy snacks. Like, weren't Takis out for years before this? Takis are like a burning hot snack. Yeah. It's the same thing. Like, Cheetos is just a burning hot snack version of something that already existed, just like Takis. So this whole thing, I call bullshit in this whole story. I think it's going to come out that this is like the Iron Eyes Cody of snack production. This last 2 weeks, the only news in fast food was chicken related. Last episode, we talked about how KFC was following Burger King into the breach by making a taco. They said, you make a taco, we're going to make a taco. So, you know, Burger King gets real heat for putting out an Impossible Whopper. KFC's, we're going to put out Impossible Chicken too. We're going to put out vegetarian chicken. So they're almost last in line, because by now everybody's put out a vegetarian meat item or talked about it or just said, hey, you know, you can ask to hold the meat at our restaurant and we'll not serve you meat. So KFC is last in line. They said they're going to put out fake chicken. And I said, okay, this KFC, they're weird. They do weird things. They have all the power in the world to make chicken happen. So are they going to put meat around a fake wooden drumstick like you always used to hear about? Remember, like, back in the day, people would talk about, oh, yeah, I went to this place in New York City, and they would serve you, like, chicken wings on wooden sticks. No, they're not doing that. So the next logical thing is to capture the zeitgeist of the moment, right, and make a chicken sandwich, a chicken patty sandwich. That would have been a great idea, because that's all anybody's talking about right now. But nope, they're not doing that. They're going to take us on a great space coaster ride all the way back to the year 1983 and make a chicken nugget. They're making a chicken nugget. That's, you can eat chicken nuggets. I'm not saying you can't, but that's a child's menu item. that hasn't been a main event literally since I was a kid. Like, you go to McDonald's, you order a burger, they'll just throw them in the bag the way like Five Guys throws fries around your sandwich. It's litter. It's like the litter of fast food. And it's sold out in like 5 minutes.
Yeah. But to be fair, I looked and the sign also says they also sell boneless wings, which are just basically bigger chicken nuggets. So you're not really fooling anybody. And for those of you who have never been vegetarian and don't know the plight of the vegetarian in the 90s, the chicken nugget has always been the one thing that's been pretty solid throughout history as far as faking with a fake meat. So, yeah, this is a pretty low-hanging fruit for them to go after. They didn't do the chicken sandwich. Which, again, is basically just a bigger chicken nugget, but still, it's, you know, it's a more of an illusion of your, like, at least trying. So it's crazy to me that it sold out so quick and people couldn't just be like, oh, wait, you know, we could just go to any store in America right now and find, like, a whole freezer's worth of this fake chicken. But good for them for trying it. If it gets people to buy it, that's cool, but I'm definitely not going to KFC for fake chicken nuggets, that's for sure.
The food scientists, like, turning their microscopes on this problem really could have been something fairly incredible. Like, if they had made like a big juicy fake chicken patty.
Yeah. Or just, I don't know the science in it. I'm not a vegetarian meat creator, but, just do something where you somehow replicate that kind of KFC chicken skin taste into a fake meat, if that's possible.
So, yeah. So this comes out, like, the timing of this in every way is fucked and suspect, because chicken sandwiches right now are having their moment, right? Like, the McChicken As I mentioned a few episodes ago, for some reason, people are talking about the McChicken. McChicken's never been special, and it didn't do anything new. Just all of a sudden, people were bored and were like, oh, I know what I can make a meme about, McChicken sandwiches, and now all of a sudden, it's like a number one thing. But this is where KFC could have really, like, driven in like a Lamborghini and covered everybody in gravel, because Popeyes just casually decided to say, hey, you know, we have a chicken sandwich with a pickle on it. And, you know, that... That's the signature item for the Ku Klux Klan of fast foods, Chick-fil-A. So the idea being like, you know, you don't have to support eugenics, whatever it is that Chick-fil-A is about that no one else is about. You can just come to Popeyes, which is everywhere. 7 days a week, we'll give you a chicken sandwich with a pickle on it. And they brought, you know, a paper airplane to a gunfight because they ran out of chicken.
Yeah.
Like within minutes of launching this sandwich, they ran out, and then they've been trying to keep the heat up by tweeting about it, like, oh, watch this space, we're gonna have chicken sandwiches back in our stores any minute now. You know, if people want to ruin Chick-fil-A because they're open homophobes or pro-life or support whatever it is that you don't like about Chick-fil-A, that's fine. But you could much more succinctly shut them down by saying, you serve waffle fries in public. I'm ready to close the doors in this place for life just for that alone. Mike, have you ever been to Epcot Center? Mike, have you ever been to Epcot Center?
No. No, I've never been to Epcot Center.
Do you wish that you had gone to Epcot Center?
No, I'm too old. I don't.
People probably don't, unless you actually know me in person, you may, or from Podcast Town or something. People may not know this, but I only collect one thing in this life. I don't collect records, despite, you know, this podcast. I don't collect Taco Bell paraphernalia, despite this podcast. But I collect the purple and orange rainbow items from Epcot Center because I like that this thing, which probably cost $1 billion, opened and on day one was out of date. It opened in like 82, but it had been built since the 70s, right? So the 70s, our ideas about the future were real shiny and cool. In the 80s, they were like Blade Runner. So the day it opened, it was already hokey and funny. I mean, I like that. I think that that's awesome. So I just started collecting those rainbow items, and I really like that thing. That's the only thing I like in the whole world, is buying garbage like keychains and paper trash that has this Epcot Center rainbow on it. The reason I bring it up is that they're going to let you become a rat and soar through food like a rat, because they're going to have a Ratatouille ride where you just become a small rat who gets to ride around in food. We talked about the Star Wars thing a few weeks ago. That's okay. But, you know, becoming a rat and cooking food is something that could get me back down to Florida. I'm kind of thinking about it. So,
I can't say I have any, interest in this. I have one of those people that, I don't know. I don't understand the adults that go to those places. So I'm not going to get into it. I don't understand the appeal as an adult, basically.
I've never thought about this, but do you even like theme parks? Like just like going to parks?
Yeah, I really don't. I don't like roller coasters. I don't want to say I'm afraid of them, but I just don't have that thrill inside of me where I'm like, this is thrilling. Like that's just not fun for me. But I don't mind going to theme parks. Like, you know, when, what is it? What's the one up there? The
Great Escape.
Yeah, Great Escape. They do the haunted stuff in October, and that's pretty sweet. And I just don't like how theme parks now are a big scam where you have to get a speed pass in order to like go on more than 3 rides in a day, because if not, you're just going to be waiting for 2.5 hours for every single ride. So yeah, I'm not like a huge theme park.
Yeah, dude, I don't go to theme parks that much anymore. So when I went back to one, and I was just like, what am I doing? What is happening here? Why am I, it's an hour and 45 minutes and no one's bothered. And there's children standing in this line with me that are not bothered by this. And it's like $200 to get into these places. Something terrible is happening, which is that Taco Bell realized they had too many items in the kitchen. So they're like, we're cutting all this. We're cutting all the stuff that you like. So, you know, on the chopping block is the Cool Ranch Dorito Tacos Locos and the Fiery Doritos Tacos Locos. I think the Fiery Doritos Tacos Locos is one of my favorite things that they've done. This is a mistake.
Well, I have a theory on this one. As far as those two go, I think it's I suffered from this too, but after they initially released the third in the series of the Doritos Locos Tacos, I completely forgot that there were 3 flavors. And the only time I would ever be reminded is every once in a while when the cashier would actually ask me which one I wanted. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I forgot there's more than one. So I feel like that's probably why, because I'm sure anybody who's even a way more casual Taco Bell eater than I am probably doesn't know that either. So they probably just never sell them.
They're getting rid of the beefy mini quesadilla, which means that they're getting rid of the Mexi-Melt completely now, because that was the way that you could still cheat the Mexi-Melt. They're getting rid of chips and salsa. Okay.
Oddly enough, it doesn't say chips and cheese, though. So it's like they still have the chips and they still have the components, but they're just not putting them together anymore.
They're getting rid of the double tostada, which I didn't even know existed. I guess I didn't. I've never. Isn't that just a pizza? I think it's just a Mexican pizza.
Yeah. I don't know.
Power menu burritos going away. Who cares? Power menu bowl. If that goes away, I'm going to have a problem, because that's my thing. That's my my highly customized item that keeps me strong. If they get rid of that, I can't go anymore. They're getting rid of the XXL grilled stuffed burrito. I guess I don't care about that, but it's kind of nice it was out there.
There's a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of people that have sent me this article, and it seems that's the consensus of what most people that aren't us are upset about. And I don't even think I've ever had it in my life. So, but it seems people are upset about it.
Double decker tacos going away. Now that's kind of heartbreaking. Double decker tacos, that's a quality item, and it's a no-brainer. Like, people make those at home. You know, to me, that's as basic as having a taco on the menu. So if you're saying we can't have a double-decker taco anymore, then what can we have? What can we even do in this place anymore?
We talked about it a couple episodes ago, but they decided to bring out the Taco Bell brand chips, tortilla chips again. I'm going to use tortilla in quotes, even though it says tortilla on the bag.
It's
but
like a,
I,
it's
my
like a
doubts,
pita chip or like a...
Yeah. It's like a pizzeria, but with a Taco Bell on it. I got a bag of these brand new Reaper Ranch tortilla chips from Taco Bell. I have in my hand. You can hear them crinkling. Just do a live taste test on the air. I've already eaten one, but just so you guys could hear the crunch at home.
That's a big crunch.
Pretty good, pretty good. Yeah, so, once again, they're on the same kind of chip that the past Taco Bell chips have been on. And that is a weird kind of... I mean, it says tortilla, but it seems like it's like a flour tortilla instead of a corn tortilla or something like that. They seem to be flour-based chips. I think I said a while ago on the show that a lot of these snacks that claim Reaper pepper or Carolina something or spider pepper or something, if you look on the ingredients, it's usually just still paprika or like something like really, really mild. But no, on the back in the ingredients list of these Taco Bell chips, it sure enough says, where is it?
Reaper dust.
Oh, yeah. It's a Carolina Reaper pepper blend. Yeah. So, yeah, it is Reaper dust. It's Maruga Scorpion and Carolina Reaper. And so it's about, it's like in the middle of the pack of ingredients. So it's not the main ingredient, but it does pack an actual pretty big heat to it for an over-the-counter tortilla chip. You know, it's not like those fucking death chips that they do a challenge with. That Pocky, or whatever that brand name is, a while back, released some Reaper Pepper, Haunted Ghost Pepper tortilla chips. And I don't think these Reaper Pepper Taco Bell chips are that hot, but they are numbing to the tongue, and they have a lingering heat to them. So I would put these, I think the mild tortilla chips are the better ones. So I would put these right behind the mild as far as the Taco Bell tortilla chip hierarchy goes. They're pretty good.
Are you breaking into a sweat at all from like a light sweat?
I did, the first time I ate them, I had a handful of them at once, and I got the sniffles. So and it lingers with you. That heat does not go away. So it's if you're a heat daredevil, here you go. Here's the chip for you.
Did I ever talk about this, that I was in a store in Montreal once, and they had salts? It was like a like a flavored salt store or whatever. And they had a ghost pepper flavor one, and I was like, oh, cool. And I just grabbed the little spoon and flung it in the back of my mouth. And I had to like run out of the store and go sit down in the alleyway and try and compose myself. Like, I thought I might actually pass out or hallucinate or die. It's not that hot, but you can't throw it to the back. You can't just be standing around like some asshole and throw a bunch of ghost pepper or whatever it was in the back of your throat. It turned out that they were actually really using ghost peppers on this shit. I was like, oh my God, I might have an event. I may have like a cardiac event. It's like the only time I've ever been brought low by a spice.
That reminds me of something that just happened to me a couple days ago. It wasn't that bad, but Brady, who listens to the show, but we went to go watch wrestling live in a bar. Not the wrestling wasn't live. We went to go as if it was a football game, go watch wrestling at a bar with other people there to watch wrestling. So that's quite a scene. But right across the street from that bar is a place called Takiera Traspasada. And he brought me there after we got done watching wrestling. And right on their awning, it has a sign that says, Home of the Black Salsa. And I'm just like, oh, what's that mean? So sure enough, they have black salsa there. And it's pretty tasty. It's black and it's salsa. It has like a pretty high like numbing effect to it, where it's almost like a Sichuan pepper or something. It doesn't really taste like that, but it kind of has that same feeling to it, where it's more Asian than Mexican, but it was pretty good. And, you know, they normal taqueria, it has the red and green salsa also on the table. And the black salsa is pretty hot. So I was just like, well, I just don't want to keep eating this black salsa. I need something a little more mild. So I reached for the red salsa. And I don't know what kind of marketing people come up with a black salsa that's pretty hot. And then the normal table red salsa, it had to be the hottest salsa I've ever had at a Mexican place. Like, my whole face, I was crying, snot was coming out of my nose. I was just sitting there trying to enjoy a taco and not be a mess. And, you know, I was drinking water and it was just like rolling right through my mouth and the heat was just staying there. And, I mean, there's no point to this story, except I think if you are going to market a black salsa, you should make that your hottest salsa and leave like the table salsas to just being like normal spice.
I actually, I don't really watch it very often, but I watched the Hot Ones with Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was pretty interesting to realize that when he's just speaking normally, he actually has like the ET Stone Cold delivery, like in real life. Yeah. He's still as though the words are being squeezed out of him like ketchup or something like that. Have you ever had any of the really hot stuff? Have you ever had any of the sauces that they show on that, like the major one, like the last dab or any of that stuff?
So it shows how many of you listen to this show, because I think I've talked about it on the show. But
I don't know.
No, I have from the last season. I have the because they change sauces every season. But from the last season, I have the first sauce, the fifth sauce, the sixth sauce, the ninth sauce, and the tenth sauce.
The one that's hot, could you put a big blob of it on a chicken wing and eat it successfully without
the last... Last season of Hot Ones, the ninth spot was something called like the Reaper, fare this, and it has like a scary Grim Reaper on the cover, and you know, flames and shit. And I think that one, as far as heat goes, is more bothersome to me than the tenth one. The tenth one's definitely hot; it's no joke, but it's like it's tolerable. I think that ninth one though is it really fucked me up one day, where it like fucked my, like I put it on eggs like an idiot. And it fucked my stomach up for the rest of the day. And I usually don't get that kind of reaction from eating hot sauce. So the 10th one, I think I could successfully eat on eggs and it would just be a little uncomfortable. But everything like the 5th, like the 6th one isn't even a big deal. So I think everything between like 1 and 6 is just like complete bullshit.
So they don't really build you up to it. They just let you die on the vine when they get up to the higher level ones.
Well... the thing is, I think when it comes to heat stuff, that Scoville unit shit, you can't really trust that. I think everybody's different. It's just like anything else. Like, your taste buds are different. Like, things that are going to bother you aren't going to bother other people. I think, you know, the fourth sauce might bother somebody more than the seventh sauce would, just because that's how their mouth works, basically. That's that's a good title for the show. That's how your mouth works. But yeah, like... I think it's all kind of relative. I think once you get within those last four sauces, it's going to be bothersome to most people, though.
Speaking of how my mouth works, we're definitely going to have to go with the Dusty theme song for this episode, because you found something pretty good on YouTube.
Yes. So, I think My Murder, She Wrote segment was a hit. I think I got like three people that said I enjoyed that, so that makes it a hit in my eyes. And I wanted to maybe... try and do like another segment like kind of in that style. I think I looked up a couple things before last episode, and there's like nothing that really like caught my fancy, but I stumbled on this thing just kind of organically, and I don't want to put it in that Murder, She Wrote pile, because I had another idea for another segment for another recurring segment for Border Boss. And that is, I was thinking about it, and, you know, Border Boss probably, it has to be the most popular Taco Bell lifestyle podcast on the internet, probably. I would have to assume, because I think it's the only one. So, and I was trying to think of ways to make it more popular, and it dawned on me that we'll never really break it into the UK because they don't really have Taco Bells.
Right.
So I thought maybe we could come up with a segment. You know, like we'll talk about some kind of British thing every few episodes to get that UK listenership. Mm-hmm. And I even thought of a segment title. It could be called The Anglophiles. Get it?
I thought it would be the Chip Buddies.
No, the Chip Buddies is a good name too. Chip Buddies. Listeners at home, British listeners, let us know. Anglophiles and files with an F, obviously. Or Chip Buddies.
Yeah.
Buddies with two T's, obviously. Let us know which is better for this. But anyway, I'm a big fan of the show Three's Company. It's ran from like 1977 to 1984, I think, if you count the spinoffs. Jack Tripper, all his, you know, Chrissy Snow, Janet, whatever her last name was, Mr. Roper, Mr. Furley, I love them all. On an old episode of Kissing Contest where we went over what our favorite fantasy movie or TV sets we would like to live on, one of my answers was the Three's Company apartment, even though that is just an apartment and I could have picked anything on earth, but I would still just pick the Three's Company apartment because I love how it looks.
Yeah.
And so the other day in my recommends on YouTube, a video popped up that was like 10 things you didn't know about Three's Company, and I usually just avoid this shit because who fucking cares, honestly, right. And I clicked on it. And I honestly, there was a lot of stuff I didn't know. Yeah. And it was stuff that was pretty interesting to me. And I think I heard in passing a while ago that Three's Company was originally based on a British TV show. But since it was so long ago, I kind of just was like, whatever. They probably just took the name or something.
Right.
It probably wasn't like literally based on a British TV show. Just like I've never went back and checked the show that All in the Family is based on, because I'm just like, it's probably like such a little connection.
Yeah, Sanford and Son is based on a British TV show that is way old, I think, called Steptoe and Son.
Yeah.
And there's no way that they got Sanford and Son directly from something called Steptoe and Son.
Yeah, so there's this, you know, through this 10 things you didn't know about Three's Company, I'm finding out a lot about this British television show. Like, for instance, the reason the Ropers were made, if you guys don't know, Three's Company, after a few seasons, they try to spin off the Ropers, the landlords, into having their own show called The Ropers. Mm-hmm. And the reason that show was made is because they already... Basically, the original English version of Three's Company ran from like 73 to 76 or something, or 77. Yeah. And then the American version started right after. So the reason they spun off the Ropers is because the version of the Ropers in England was a huge success. So they were just like, oh, we'll do the same thing here. And no one that was cast in the Ropers wanted to do it. They all wanted to stay in Three's Company. The reason they spun off Three's a Crowd was because they did that in England, and that was a huge hit. So yeah. It was kind of like the British TV show was really the same trajectory as the English TV show, or American TV show. So I was like, I should check this out. There's got to be clips on the internet, and it turns out there's some savior has put up the whole entire series and all of the spinoff series of Man About the House, which is the Three's Company title in the UK. And it is insane how note for note, pitch perfect this is. It is like they did like a note for note remake in the American version. And that is so crazy to me because throughout my whole life, I have always felt that like Three's Company was like kind of the epitome of American comedy, basically, where like the comedy to me seems incredibly American in Three's Company. It does not seem like a thing that another country could invent, because I mean all of the Three's Company plot setups are basically like a misunderstanding that would be settled in 2 seconds in real life, and then they just go into like wacky slapstick comedy and stuff like that. It just seems incredibly American, but it turns out this all existed in England 5 years before it existed in America.
Verbatim.
The guy instead of named Jack Tripper is named Robin Tripp. And there's a Chrissy, but she plays the brunette. So she plays the Janet role. It's kind of like how in Street Fighter, Balrog is M. Bison in Japan. It's kind of just like they flipped him. And the other woman's name is Joe, I think, or Chloe.
Joe.
I already forgot, but Joe, yeah. And she is like, she's a blonde, but at the same time, there's no like ditzy blonde. They're kind of both on the same intelligence level. And the pilot starts out, it's the same exact way. It's after a party. They go into the bathroom, and the Jack Tripper character is sleeping inside of the bathtub. And, you know, from there, hijinks ensue. And it's crazy. If you watch the pilot, there is, once they open the curtain and see the Jack Tripper, Robin Tripp, sleeping in the bathtub. There's a woman in the live studio audience that cannot hold in her laughter. She's laughing for so long just by herself, just like cackling at just the idea of this man in a bathtub. But it's the same kind of setup. The landlord, is not the Ropers in this, but it's a Mr. Roper type character. He doesn't want a guy living with two girls. And then they tell him that he's gay. And then he's like, okay. And again, that's like such an American thing to me that it just never crossed my mind that British people would have thought that first. They call him a poof in the pilot, which I don't think is a thing you could say anymore.
Right. The punchline of the whole episode is.
Yeah. He says, it's at the very end of the pilot. She's like, the Janet character is like, oh yeah, you could live here. We told him and everything's cool. And Jack Tripper's like, oh, what do you tell him? And she says, we told him you're a poof. And then the credits roll. It's like a stinger. It ends on a stinger like that. And it's, but aside from that, I'm going to say it. I don't think this is too crazy to say, but everything in the American version is better. There the few differences that you could contest with is, I think, because in the original, if you guys don't know, the Jack Tripper character is kind of supposed to be like a sleazy guy. He's supposed to be like a poon hound, sleazy guy you don't want to trust when you first see him. But Jack Tripper is such a wholesome looking guy that never really came across in the Three's Company. He always looked like a trustworthy guy, so it was just kind of something you had to overlook. This guy, this Robin Tripp guy, looks a little more sleazy and untrustworthy, so it makes sense. The Roper characters are not exactly the same. They're not better, but it's more interesting because in the American version, Mrs. Roper is just, she's always horny. And she's always trying to have sex with Mr. Roper, but he's kind of just mean and, like, you know, shrugs her off. And in this version, it seems like the Mr. Roper character is kind of afraid to have sex with her, where he's just like, I don't know if he's so repulsed by her or whatever it is, but he's just like not into it. But he's still horny too, just not for her. The Larry Dallas character is so lame compared to the American version. The Regal Beagle, which is my dream bar, it just looks like any British pub I've ever seen in a movie in my whole entire life. But it's worth checking out. Like I said, just search Man About the House and the entire series will pop up. It's crazy because there's so many episodes that are note for note remakes, or not remakes, but there are Three's Company's note for note remakes of Man About the House. And my world is flipped upside down. I don't know what to think about American comedy anymore. I'm gonna have to probably like look up some books and
you have to dig up all the old Carry On movies. There's like 900 of these movies that they make that all have like Mad Magazine poster. It went all the way from like the 40s or 50s to like today or something like that. So I was also surprised by this. Like I said, like with the Sanford and Son thing, you know that there's some like obvious like it's barely the germ of the original idea. There's no way that they made Three's Company 5 or 6 years before in England. They did. They absolutely did, except for it's filthy. Like, the scenes are filthy. It looks like the Young Ones. You know, it's like the same, like, it's the same awful, destroyed 70s London look. Everything's gray. When he's in the bathwater, the bathwater is just filthy, horrible. It's like they use real life. It's like they filmed it in real life. They didn't do any set design or anything like that. Mrs. Roper, in addition to being horny, is a little bit more threatening in this one.
Yes,
because she actually leaves the house. She's not like in the American Mrs. Roper is always in a famously always in a moo-moo and always just kind of like, you know, around the building and just, and there's no real threat. Like, you don't actually think she's trying to, well, maybe, you know, I don't know, but you don't necessarily think that she's any sort of real option for Jack at any time. But this lady is out at bars, and when she sees Jack, she's like, she's got clacking jaws and she's ready to take a bite. She actually has that sly look in her eyes, like she's really legitimately scheming to have her husband in the apartment upstairs fixing some plumbing or something so she can get her plumbing fixed downstairs. But Robin is definitely, he kind of does look like John Ritter. He's got John Ritter in the eyes a little bit. Like, there's something there when I saw him. It's like, he kind of does look like him, except, you know, mashed into the British face, like that, you know, Prince Charles, whatever happens to British people, they all look like Monty Python. You know, it just happens. Like, the thing that I noticed most of all, is that at the beginning, the opening, is that there's like a, you know, opening kind of like, you know, Odd Couple style walking around the city montage. They spend a huge amount of time on Joe's butt.
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah,
Joe's the blonde roommate, and she's walking through the beginning scenes wearing like this weird yellow outfit where it goes, it's like pulled up in a huge wedgie up in her butt crack, but only halfway. Like the line stops halfway up her butt as though there was like a piece of gaffer's tape or something. They put the camera right on that crack and they're like, check this out. Check out this ass. And then that ass walks through town and men are admiring it and things are going on. And it's, you just kind of fall into this vortex. Like, how long are they going to do this? They just keep showing you more scenes of her walking around in her lemon yellow outfit being the hit.
There is a part so she walks out of a building and there's supposed to be like a homeless man holding up like, you know, we'll do whatever for food kind of sign. And, you know, it's like, boing, and he, like, throws the sign in the air, and he, like, focuses in on her ass, and it zooms into it, and it's just like, I guess, maybe this was a hot ass in 1973 London, I don't know.
You know, the Thames logo sends me back to Benny Hill. When I see that logo, I'm like, I have to have seen this, like, 500,000 times, like, there has to have been millions and millions of shows that have this Thames logo that it just seems like that's what you saw when you saw a British show when we were kids. Not really. It's like Benny Hill, Mr. Bean, and a Man About the House. Like, things, they didn't. It's not as much stuff. I mean, that those are the obviously those. That's the holy trinity of comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are very important. But I just thought it was everywhere, and it's not. It was just like some. It was like some branch of British cable TV or something like that that just happened to make some of the finest shows that were ever made. And that we get to see this logo over and over. My final thing is that I really only watched a few episodes of this, so it's kind of a random scattering of things. But there's the second episode, I think, one of the mothers comes to stay, and they're trying to keep it a secret that Jack is in the house. And she goes into the room for the night, and she lays down in the bed, and she turns on the lamp. And the lamp is a naughty lamp that has full frontal nudity with, like, what appears to be actual pubic hair, like a piece of something simulating pubic hair on the item. And I was like, man, that's like, I kind of want that. I kind of want to own this item. Welcome to the second half of the Border Boss and Friends podcast, where Mike and I delve into the records that you grew up listening to and we skipped because we had other shit to do. We want to be the internet's foremost experts on records, records of all sorts, and we want to be, you know, we want to be the person that you go to, the wise older boy that you come to when you want to ask questions about Danzig records, for example. What are the good Danzig records? I don't know yet. We'll probably find that out soon. We're probably going to do something about that. Mike, are you a Danzig fan?
I like the first three.
Yeah. So we'll start with four. what we try to do is we pick an album that is in our purview, but we skipped, like a metal album or something like that, that we just never got around to. And then we try and pick something that you probably think is important. You're not right, but something that you think is important, and we experience it. Or it could be something that we listened to the first time around and just didn't get. You know, when you're young, you don't always have all the tools that you need to get things done. So maybe we'll revisit some stuff that we gave short shrift to once upon a time. All holes filled. We're going to fill all available holes with knowledge, with experience. And then immediately forget it. Have you, Mike? Have you gone back to listen to any of the things? Is anything in your repertoire? Are you building?
This is actually a pretty good segue that I wasn't planning on talking about. But the other day I did have a lot of time to sit around and listen to music, and I was like, I promised myself I'd listen to this stuff. And the last episode, you talked about how the real actual best ZZ Top record was Da Gaio. So I went back and listen to that. I think you're wrong. That record has a lot more of the the Roseanne type music on it than it does have good music.
Yeah.
And there is a song on there called, I think it's called Manic Mechanic, or yeah, something, some alliteration of mechanic. And I think I've found one of the Border Boss's influences, because that voice, the kind of vocal weird cartoon voice he does on that song is very similar to the Border Boss Cigarette News theme song. It's almost the same voice. So.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, so I like that song. I went back and listened to the two Steely Dan records before and after Asia. The one after is, I think, famous too. It's Gaucho. And I think that one is a little too... it came out in 1980, and it sounds like it came out in the 80s, even though it's still the early 80s. And I think the things I admired about his lyrics on Asia go way over the top on this one, and it's just kind of like almost a parody of itself, and I'm not too into that. But the one before that, I didn't get to listen to that one as extensively, but that seems to be a little more my shit, so... So, you know, pretty mixed bag, but I did go back and listen to a couple.
So we're getting there. We're slowly eking our way towards expertise. This week, I picked Guided by Voices B-1000, 1994 Scat Records. And I like that name. I think B-1000, that's funny. I don't know if it means anything. It's a funny name. I think that's pretty cool. you know, when we go back to do one of these kind of bands, one of these like 90s, like indie god, you know, one of these like, you know, Mount Rushmore indie bands for other people, I never know what to expect. We're dusting off something that I have zero experience with, and I'm just always bracing myself. I'm expecting like some half-ass twangy jangle, like embarrassed man vocals. I'm expecting the band where everyone in the band is making stupid faces because they're just so over the fact that they're playing instruments and, you know, isn't everything just so stupid? My whole band is rolling their eyes right now. We're just a whole set of rolling eyes. These days, I'm not sure whether the band I'm imagining in my brain actually exists, because we've listened to a couple of these now. Pavement would have been the number one that I would have thought was that way, and they turned out to be competent. Dinosaur Jr., not far. Like, they have terrible vocals, but they're still shredding, you know, so I'm waiting. I don't know. Maybe it's Wilco. I don't know. Maybe we'll get there. We're going to get to the slacker, confused, alt-country grunge thing that's in my head. I thought for sure it was this band. I'm going to get off track a little bit here, but around the time that I was aware of Guided by Voices, it was like 2001 or something like that. And at that time, I had this embargo. I didn't want to hear bands with male singers unless they were metal or had synthesizers. I hated everything from the Beatles to Weezer. I just don't like rock or pop that doesn't meet that criteria. And then Trail of Dead put out this one sick album, misleadingly sick album, because nothing else they put out is any good. And then I start reading Pitchfork every day. I just really was a mess at this time. But Guided by Voices put out this really cool looking album named Isolation Drills. It had like a cool cover, and Isolation Drills, that's a cool name. And they had a semi-hit single called Skills Like This. That's neat. That's a neat song title. And then, you know, whoops, I listened to the album and it's very soft and milky and not that challenging sounding. So I never look back. But, you know, now I'm different. I'm amenable to the sounds of mild white men. So this album, B-1000, was brought up by one of our listeners. And I think, Mike, you even had it on your list, so I stole it from you. Mm-hmm. This album has a massive conceit that you need to accept and move past almost immediately, which is that it's like recorded on someone's boombox or someone's dad's business microcassette memo recorder or something like that, and then edited with a garden weasel. It is extremely lo-fi and not like in a confrontational noise guy intentional way. It's just like, hey, we had a coupon and we saved some money and here's our album. Instruments cut out, they drop off, everything's mushed together. It's like this compressed smear. There's no low end. There's no like width at all to this. It sounds kind of like your earbuds are busted. There's a song named Yours to Keep that leads into this song called Echoes Myron. And it almost seems like they came up with this, you know, acoustic clean channel buildup to the more rocking part, but they couldn't pull that off. So there's just like a meat cleaver cut between those two songs. It just stops dead, and then they're already playing some other song. It doesn't sound intentional. It sounds like a mistake. This whole album is just it's a mess by any traditional standards. But, you know, when I put it on and it turned out to not be that slacker alt country I was expecting, I was intrigued. I was like, ah, this is not bad in the way I thought it was going to be bad. So I decided that they suckered me. I listened to the whole thing. You know, I actually paid attention. I don't mind it. It's like decent under the smear of Vaseline that you have to listen through to get to it. This is pretty decently executed, like British invasion rock. You know, some parts sound like the Hollies or something like that. Some parts sound like the Zombies. It's all kind of it's just general rock, but it has these soaring choruses. And the singers are really energetic and they're trying and they don't sound embarrassed to be singing. They don't sound like they were surprised to find themselves in front of a microphone. They're like there on purpose. They're harmonizing. The guitars are all really, really out of tune, but you know, whatever. What are you gonna do about that? The one cheat that I think goes on the whole album, it kind of sounds like there's a lot of guitars. I don't know what the setup of this band is at all. I never looked at a picture of them. There could be 40 dudes in this band. That it seems like they would do that. but they do this cheat where there's one guy who's just always playing nonstop and never mutes, never really changes a chord. Like the guitarists up front are doing all this detail work, and then this guy is in the back just going like blam 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 blam. And that's a kind of cheap way to make a lo-fi recording sound haunting and epic. And you know, now I've said a couple of keywords, border boss keywords, so you can get out your bingo card and you figure out that I like this album. I thought it was cool. I don't know if I'm ever going to be like really want to listen to it again, just because it's really muddy and really shitty. But musically, it's pretty cool. It's pretty interesting. It's something like a couple of these songs are probably going to stick in my head. I don't know. Maybe they redid it. That's going to come up later in this episode, redoing albums. So maybe they bought new guitars and redid this or something like that. And I'll check that out. But Mike, what did you think of B-1000?
I kind of had the same feel, as the same kind of background with Scott, but with kind of a different result. Basically, I had this on my list, as Scott said, and I had like no real desire to ever do it. It's been on there forever. And then Kevin Moss from Junk Food Dinner, kind of like when we post about Border Boss and Podcast Town and All Holes Filled, he kind of recommended this record, and he kind of described it, and it made me think this record wasn't what I've always thought it was, because the way he described it, he made it sound like it was kind of like a difficult record to listen to. And up until that, I always assumed this was another one of those like, oh, this is like today's hottest alt rock band. And then you hear it and it's just like super poppy. And I'm just like, I don't fucking care. And I thought this was going to just be, cause I don't know, Guided by Voices, the name to me always just sounded like some super poppy band that is like disguised themselves as some kind of alt rock, but it's not really alt rock. And so I was like very surprised when I put this on and it was like super lo-fi. And that's the other thing about this record is that, so when I grow up, I think I was like around 8 or 9 when the original 120 Minutes came out, which was different from, I think when people refer to 120 Minutes now, they refer to like the newer, like almost on its last legs, 120 Minutes. But you know, when it originally came out, like in the late 80s, I think it was, or maybe, yeah, late 80s, I think it 120 Minutes came out. It was like truly like you were seeing videos from another world, because it was like, it was just like you never saw these videos. And like one of the times I remember seeing It's the End of the World as We Know It by REM before they were famous on 120 Minutes. And that video is like always stuck with me. I think it's like one of my favorite videos. Not so much the song, but I really like the video. And so you'd see like these weird videos and all the bands kind of sounded, you know, kind of weird compared to other stuff that you would hear on MTV all day. And then, you know, a few years later is when Nirvana came out and alt rock basically became mainstream popular rock music. Yeah. And at that point, I was like old enough to start buying music. So I always knew like out there in the world, there was some kind of like lower fi, dirtier alt rock than what I was hearing on MTV. But I had no reference. Like I was getting into hardcore at that time, so I knew it was out there, but anytime I heard any band that was even the slight bit underground, it would still just sound like poppy bullshit. And it wasn't really like I was searching for this stuff, but I just knew it always existed. And it turns out it was Guided by Voices. This is like the band I've been looking for since, you know, since I was a teen in the 90s to like kind of like sew it all together for me. Not that I'm saying, I still don't think I would have liked this in the 90s, but I would have been like, this is kind of the sound that has been in my head when I thought of like alt rock, basically, like, you know, just basically like I said about Dinosaur Jr. I'm not that familiar with Dinosaur Jr., but when I think about alt rock in my head, like the sound of Dinosaur Jr. is what pops up. And this Guided by Voices sound is the same thing. This is like what I was looking for that whole time. And I'm gonna say it though, it's a little negative, is that, as you guys know from listening to this podcast, I am a bit of a rock and roll music purist at this point. So I just want to say that I don't like records that don't sound like actual records, and this sounds like a bunch of demos and like fucking, you know, just rehearsals and shit like stitched together, and I'm kind of not into that. But at the same time, I'm kind of not into that in my current present day. I think in the 90s, I would have been down with that, because in 2000, whenever it came out, 2005, I think it came out, I heard Ariel Pink for the first time, the worn copy, but Ariel Pink's Haunted Graffiti worn copy. And that is like the lowest of lo-fi as far as sound goes. And I was mesmerized by that record in 1995. I just thought that was what he was doing by himself and making like this weird fucking bedroom music. I was just like, this is fucking insane. So I think, you know, that was fucking 10 years, 11 years after this Guided by Voices record came out. So I think if I heard this in a more timely manner, I would have probably been pretty blown away by it. And just like Scott said, it's like the recording is to the point where there's one song, one of the cleaner acoustic songs, where you could hear like his chair creaking. And it's just like, oh, come on, man. Like, you know, I get it, but it's just like you could have muted that or something. I don't know. I don't need that much of a organic sound, I guess you would say. But the Kevin's description kind of scared me off on this. I thought it was going to be real shit, because he said it was like a hard record to just pick up for the first time and listen to. But I think Kevin was fucking wrong, man. I think as far as the All Holes Filled crew goes, I think this is kind of the types of records we're usually looking for.
Even though it's lo-fi and challenging in some ways, there's not a lot weird about it. So you're not going to listen to this and be like, oh my God, my mind's blown. This is so crazy. It's more like, hey, wow, this garbage shitty tape that sounds like it was underwater for a month has some pretty decent pop music on it. I'm not displeased to be listening to it.
But yeah, I do think this is a good record. I do think if you are into the alt rock and that type of shit and you've never heard this, this is a good hole to fill. So my first one of the night, I'm going to apologize in advance for this. I'm very sorry about this. Everybody listening to this at home, it's a band called Lucero, or maybe they might be Italian. It might be Lucero. I don't know, but I think it's Lucero. It's from 2003. It's a record called That Much Further West. This is their third record, so this isn't even like a debut or anything. So just a little backstory, and part of my apology is that I think I was under the impression that this was like a huge band that everybody knew. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I think I screwed up. Our friend that listens to the show, Brian, a.k.a. the Thrift Store Jobber, you can find him on Instagram selling old wrestling and NASCAR shirts and a bunch of other old crappy shit. That's his business. This is one of his favorite bands. And I remember hearing like other punk people talking about this band, you know, back then. And even to this day, I still hear the name mentioned, but I think it's just one of those deals where I just happen to be around an inordinate amount of people that like this band for some reason. And they aren't actually as popular as I think they are, because they're still going. And they get under 100,000 regular listeners a month on Spotify, which, you know, 100,000 is a lot. But for the most part on this show, we're either dealing with huge bands or things that are like very, very much in our wheelhouse. So this is kind of just like, I'm very sorry for anybody not interested in this. The second misconception I had about this is I thought this was going to be more like that Dillinger 4 record we listened to a few months back. I thought it was going to be that kind of like sensitive pop punk about memories and stuff like that. And it's not. The other thing about this is if you look it up on any source you look it up on, it lists punk rock as the first genre. It's not punk rock. There's nothing punk about this. The second genre list is country or alt country. And nope, I don't hear that either. And in some websites listed as emo, that's a third strike. That's three strikes against this record. I cannot think of any other fucking record on the face of the earth that has three different genre categories, and it's wrong on all of them. That's pretty amazing. I think, like, if you put this record on and you didn't tell anybody what kind of genre it is, I don't think they would definitely not guess punk rock. I can see if you were really into country music and knew, like, the elements of what made up country music, and you didn't have that just, like, kind of redneck stereotype country music in your head all the time, like I do. Like in my brain, the image of country music I have is like Merle Haggard. But if you knew, like, you know, the trappings of country music, you can maybe make a case that this is alt country. But that's probably the only one. It's garbage. I mean, this is probably this has to be the worst record I've ever listened to on the show. This is fucking terrible from top to bottom. It's basically like, to me, it honestly sounds like a less experienced Nickelback, basically. the singer, he does have that kind of like Nickelback Creed, the throaty strained vocals, like, look at this photograph. When I do, it makes me laugh. Like, he has that voice, and that was right there. Like, as soon as he starts singing like that, I was like, I don't know if I'm gonna make it through this whole record. I don't know if I did make it through this whole record, to be honest, because that is the worst singing voice you could have. And you know, he was doing this. This is 2002. This is, according to Brian, their most accessible record. I don't know if it's their biggest record or their most famous record, but it's definitely like their biggest, most accessible record. And so he was doing this in, you know, peak Creed time. He was doing this, look at this vote. He was doing that voice. And I don't know why it didn't dawn on him or the rest of the band to go, hey, man, I don't want anybody to think we're Creed. Maybe tone it down a little. So that's strange. The musically, it is... there's like the first couple tracks are a little poppy, and I can imagine them having a video, and but a lot of it is like a very simple melody, with some guy fucking dicking around on guitar in the background. Not even like a hard dicking around, just like the beginning of a practice noodling on his guitar, which I guess is maybe an element of country music where you don't think about that often. So I guess that's where it's alt country, is like they have a fucking guy who dicks around on guitar, and while playing a simple melody. I mean, it's to the point where there's one song, I can't remember the track name, but it is like, it's like the fucking Metallica Sad But True, or whatever that song is, where he just hits the three notes over and over again. That's like, he does that in one of these tracks. It's a guy playing the same three strings on a guitar just over and over again, while a guy dicks around on guitar in the background. And it's just terrible. There's nothing redeeming about this record. It's the only thing I can give them credit for is I do remember hearing a lot more of this music, like post-2003, post-2002. And like, you know, EVR was fucking filled to the brim with bands that sounded like this at this point. Like Copeland. And I know, you know, if you're like a Copeland fan, you're going to argue with me that they didn't sound like this. But it's the same shit. It's like, it's just boring white person music. I would, you know, I was grasping. I was like, maybe this guy's lyrics are good. I didn't read them or anything, but I listened to them, and I'm just like, this is fucking just milquetoast, like boring lyrics too. This is not anything that's great. It defies logic to me that this band got any type of popular at all, because it's so bargain bin. Like, I mean, it's hard for me to think of what was happening in 2003 where anybody would catch on to this, but it just sounds like such a bargain bin band that I don't know what stood out to them outside of maybe they kind of created alt country. Yeah. And again, this country bullshit that saying this is country is just ridiculous. I mean, Scott's a little more of an expert on country music, meaning he's listened to like five more country records than I have. So maybe he can shed some light on this. But yeah, I don't know, man. I was severely let down that a friend I know listens to this music, and B, that it was this bad, because there's nothing to like on this record, unfortunately. I feel bad that I had to bring this into anybody's life. Maybe if you are a fan of alt country, you actually enjoy this record. But I can't think of more things I could possibly hate more than this record. But what did you think, Scott?
Okay, so yeah, so here's the slacker bullshit alt rock I was looking for earlier. I found it. I was expecting to find it on a Wilco album or something like that, but it was right here. Like, I'm hiding on all these weirdly bland epitaphy gruff band bands. And I think there was a bunch of this. For a minute, I think there was like Titus Andronicus, all these bands that were doing like Heartland rock punk, you know, like trying to sound like Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, but you know, whatever. Every word on this album is delivered in that gravelly, like, I gave her all I got and it weren't good enough delivery. And it really makes you notice how weak the guitars are. The guitars are super weak. Like, I don't know what they're even, I don't know what you could, like, it's like maybe it's a scratch track or a preset or something like that. It's like, There's no balls to anything on this. There's actually a song called Hate and Jealousy, and it has this kind of like big post-hardcore slamming idea, at least going through the middle of it. But it's being played through this cheap, thin sounding distortion that makes like Oasis sound like Black Sabbath. And once that's over, they just launch into a song with like a bunch of fucking fiddles. But I mean, you want to talk about incel rock. This whole album is like a gallery of different ways a dude can be disappointing to a woman. Even before he starts repeatedly calling them little girls, multiple songs across multiple songs, he refers to them as little girls. There's just like a slut shaming song where he talks about some little girl who's fucking a whole band in a van somewhere, which like, I'm not 100% sure. Like, you know, I never partied that hard when I was young, but I don't think that happens at all unless you're Motley Crue. That's a story that incels make up that, you know, the Chad band is getting the girls or whatever. It's not real. All of, you know, the whole thing sucks, and it's all being delivered in this dollar store John Mellencamp voice, and it's like fucking skin crawling. It is totally skin crawling. Brian, I'm confused, guy. You're like, most of the time you seem to listen to okay stuff. I'm confused. What, like, give me a lifeline here. Like, let me know what's the deal.
To be fair, he said this wasn't his favorite Lucero album, so I guess maybe the earlier stuff is way harder than this or something. I don't know.
So we'll have to try Lucero again sometime, see if we can find it. My next album of the night was Meshuggah's Nothing. Don't be surprised by this, all right? You know, don't be surprised by this. We'll get to why I might not have listened to this, but 2002, Nuclear Blast, and then again in 2006 on Nuclear Blast, 4 years later. I know that maybe you're not all metalheads. A lot of our listeners probably aren't metalheads, really. So for those of you who don't know, this band and this album, I think, more or less created a genre of metal that is alive and well now called djent, with a D at the beginning. It's a genre that at the same time that it's extremely complicated and challenging, it's also incredibly bland because it relies on this one very specific sound, which is that the lowest string is tuned down to almost nothing, and it's just being banged on in a mathematical way through like a series of weird computer plugins. It's every band does the same thing. They all, and I can't stress this enough, they do the same thing. You would not know that you've put on a different album. It's this is on every one of them, and it's a genre. It's a genre with astronomical barriers to entry, because you need to have at least one guy in the band who has like supreme mastery of polyrhythm, music theory, math, and then the rest of the guys need to keep up with that guy and do all these math homework problems disguised as songs. And to do so, you need to own one of a fairly limited range of futuristic laser gun guitars with 8 strings on them running through an Axe FX equipped computer. Otherwise, you can't even jam. You guys can't hit the first note unless everyone in the band has all this shit. And
it's like Neo Geo. It's like the Neo Geo of music.
It is. You can't practice until you all have the stormtrooper rifle that goes dong da dong 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 bang dong dong. They don't play like heavy power chords like Metallica. They don't play through like giant coliseums of ancient distortion like Isis or Neurosis or something. They all literally just clobber that one fucking string in like these dance resistant patterns. Clong, 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 clong. You know, and then almost all the bands also will at some point just explode into this like vast jazz fusion Sega Master System galaxy of notes. Like, the song will stop for a second, and all of a sudden there'll be like a brightly colored sky of notes in front of you and all these like harmonies and beautiful like vaporwave guitar solos. It just happens for a minute. It's rad. It's awesome. And then we just go back to bong, 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 bong. And it sounds like someone mic'd a wash tub bass and they're running it through like a Krait combo amp. That's what the bottom note sounds like. So this is a weird genre to have taken hold. It's massive, but it's also it's massively popular. It's real. This is a real thing. The entire genre. It's also a meme at the same time that it's hugely popular. It's a whole genre that's also a meme and a punchline. And you know, like, imagine if you had to go to med school to open up a shop where customers kick you in the balls. That's djent. That's like the work that goes into being in a djent band versus the reward. And so the reason that I don't really know Meshuggah is that, or I haven't really listened to a lot of Meshuggah, I should say, is that when they first dropped, this was the band that was for the skinny, wiry dude in your clique who worked like a really physical job and wore skull bandanas still. And he's been smelling like cigarettes since the third grade. So, you know, all the jokes that you guys are making right now about Tool, which that's fine. You keep doing that. But Meshuggah was blowing the minds of soda merchandisers and carpet delivery men since years. Like, this was the one string band that, like, the dude in a groove metal band in your neighborhood, he couldn't believe Meshuggah. So it just... there was absolutely nothing there for me at the time. So I skipped it. I skipped Meshuggah entirely. Years go by, and now guess who's amenable to djent? And guess who's amenable to shitty prog metal and all kinds of other dumb stuff? Me. So, you know, these guys invented that genre. And then, you know, when they didn't think that they'd invented it hard enough, they went back and completely re-recorded it. Because unfortunately, like when they did the first one, true djent gear didn't exist. This is all true. Like the guitars that people use these days didn't exist yet, or they were like on order and Amazon didn't have Prime yet, so they didn't get to the door fast enough. So they were forced to just tune regular 7-string guitars down to do the album originally. So I listened to both. But I started with the newer version because, like, you know, despite everything I said over the past 2 minutes, I want to listen to this stuff. I want to listen to this like proggy bullshit stuff. So I figured the state-of-the-art version had to be the place to go, right? Get right into it. Because they're still a band, and they're still a band that people like. So it's not like... they're not like Metallica with, like, Load, like, where they came back after Load and tried to do Master of Puppets or something like that. It's not that. This is going to be state-of-the-art, right? Not at all. The jury is totally still out. You could, like, throw a dart. Pick the one that you like. Because I think the yellow version from 2002 sounds way more lively and heavy and fun. But the problem is, I don't think that's their goal. So if you're a person who likes this music... maybe that sounds like shit to you. It sounds like raw and crappy and messy, because the end result of this music literally sounds like metal being played for the aliens from Aliens by the aliens from Aliens. This is like totally insect-like music from like a race of super ants. We're like, this is music, right? Like this? This is music? It never chills out. It never ramps up. It's just one sound that gets reorganized in a different numerical pattern for each track. And I think that that really becomes magnified once they finally got their space age gear and got to remove every last ember of warmth and human concern from this package, because the newer one is like bloodless. It's so, you know, you listen to a song like Perpetual Black Second. I think it's like maybe the fourth song. I can't remember. And, you know, the distorted rubber band guitar riff is so separate from the drums. You start to lose track of whether they even know if they're playing it right anymore. Like everything becomes so, so numerical. It's exhausting to listen to. And they also, in the new reversion, they ran the singer through some kind of like Al Jorgensen chorus pedal effect. So now he sounds more like Megatron's dirtbag cousin. But on the plus side, both versions definitely feature the spacey experimental lead guitars. It's like a boss battle in the middle of all the clanging. It just... all of a sudden, like it just erupts. But other than that, this album felt like a chore. This felt like a chore for my ears, you know, to listen to. Not because it was bad or anything, just because like it's the same thing. It's the same, like literally the same sound constantly being just clobbering you. I would say the blue one is like a sweatshop version of chores, and the yellow one is like barnyard chores. So whichever one of those sounds more cool to you, choose that one. But I'll say this, when I told my guitarist that we were doing Meshuggah, he didn't vouch for him or anything, but he sent me a video. It's one of the best rock videos I've ever seen. It's called New Millennium Cyanide Christ, and maybe it's old news, I have no idea. But it's great partially because it's just Meshuggah air guitaring a song on a tour bus, which doesn't sound like Meshuggah to me. Like they're just on a tour bus, like having fun, and they seem to be human beings while someone's recording them on like a VHS camera. And the drummer is incredible at air drumming. He's sitting up on the top bunk and he's hitting something in space that's not there perfectly every single time. And he's just looking at you with his weird sunglasses. It's great. And also, this song has a for real crescendo. You don't believe me? Scrub up to around 3 minutes, 30 seconds, 4 minutes. The singer is singing into a ballpoint pen, which is hilarious. And all of a sudden, the song starts to change. He starts screaming super loud. The music builds up. And I'm like, holy shit, I had no idea these guys used to fuck with dynamics. But Mike, what did you think of Meshuggah Nothing?
Before I get into Meshuggah, since we'll never actually talk about this for a full segment of the show. And speaking of alien metal, did you like that band Origin?
I kind of do. And they're also, they have local interest.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I kind of do. I think I like older Origin a little bit better because it's the same. Like, there's like some, the life gets stripped out of them as they go on. But they're, there's a band called Hate Eternal, who is like a pretty well-worn. They've been around forever. They're one of those death metal bands that no one would ever call their favorite band, but everyone kind of likes them. And Origin, for me, they're incredible, but they're like the tech metal version of that. Like, I listen to them like, man, this is incredible. This is like sweat-inducing. I can't believe they can do this. And as soon as I hit stop, I'm not going to hit play again ever again.
Yeah. No, I get it. But yeah, that's when I think of alien metal. They're definitely number one in my heart as far as... Wow, this actually sounds like music made by an alien. But no, as far as Meshuggah goes, so I did have a little leg up on Scott on this one. So back when, you know, the late, I guess it was the late 90s is when Meshuggah first came out, their debut LP, which is, it's like a three-word name. It's like, you know, recycle, reuse, resist. Or, you know, it's just one of those three-word things. Yeah. That was when I listened to college radio WFMU in New Haven. WNHU in New Haven. Pretty hardcore. That was like my pipeline to the underground music, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was basically like every Saturday they played three shows. I think it was three or four shows. One of them was like mostly hardcore. And then there was like two that were in the middle. And then there was like another one that played like war and stuff like that. And when something was like big, they would like all the shows would play the same thing. And once that Meshuggah record hit, all the shows played that Meshuggah record, that first one. And I didn't hate it, but I also didn't love it. It was like, even back then, and this is before they kind of basically birthed the gent, they were still very clinical. And like, it was very clinical, like monolithic music where it's just like, it sounds like robots made it. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. But I remember, I still remember this day. I forgot so many important things in my life. But one of the dumbest things I remembered is one of those DJs saying, you know, mark my words, Meshuggah is going to be the next Metallica. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, you know, at the time I was, you know, 16 or something, 15. And I was like, this 20-year-old man who has his own radio show probably knows everything there is to know about metal. So maybe Meshuggah is going to be the next Metallica. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, from 98 to you know, 2006, I think it's safe to say no one thought Metallica was going to become, or Meshuggah was going to become the next Metallica. And I remember hearing this record when it was new. I think, you know, not the re-recording, but the one of the initial release. And I think this was the last Meshuggah thing I ever listened to. I don't even know what the fuck they sound like now, but I'm sure it's the same shit. But I remember a friend coming over and playing it, and me just being like, "Man, this is just like impenetrable music. It's just like I don't get it." I think this is just like too technical and above me. It still sounds very robotic and cold. And, that was it. That was the end of Meshuggah for me. And then I didn't even know they re-recorded this record. So, so then, you know, Scott told me, and I also listened to that version, and it is insane how much more robotic that version is. That really, they really hit the goal. There's the only thing that even sounds like it was made by like human, the only thing that sounds like it had like a human touch is there's like a splash cymbal on a couple songs, and it's like, it kind of sounds like a real instrument, but everything else is just like, man, it's crazy.
I actually forgot that the splash cymbal was definitely the thing that stuck out to some song where you're going, psh, 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 and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? It's like way on top of everything else.
Yeah, it's that they could not, the technology wasn't there to make a splash cymbal sound robotic yet. So it's possible that they might go for a third re-recording of this. Splash cymbal technology might be up there where they could finally perfect this. So yeah, it's strange to listen to this, and I'm with Scott. Like, the first version definitely sounds more lively, but I also do not think that's what they want. So it's like, if you actually enjoy this music, you know, definitely that re-recording is definitely way better. But if you don't enjoy this music, then maybe you want to check out that that original version that sounds like human beings made it, sort of. But, you know, in the end, my final conclusion is that this band did kind of become the new Metallica, just for, like, kind of dickheads. But they are kind of, like, the new Metallica. And it's so crazy because, like Scott has said, it's not a good entry music. Like, you can't just pick this up and be like, Fucking yeah, bro. So I don't know how it happened. There was like, you know, that's a whole entire hole, maybe a special edition of All Holes Filled. How did we go from Meshuggah's Nothing to kids with giant, like, 75-point font t-shirts that say cunt on them for bands that make music like this? Like, what the fuck happened between 2005 and 2010 that I just don't know about?
We need to bring in a young boy and interview him.
We have to bring in a teen. If there's any teens out there in the gent music, let us know what the fuck happened between 2005 and 2010 that to make teens even understand this music. Maybe it's a guitar era. I don't fucking know. Maybe it was the popularity of drum triggers and 8-string guitars. I don't know. But my last one of the night is it's a softball. It is The Who, Who's Next by The Who. This is from 1971, and I have never heard it. The only Who I've ever heard is the pinball song, and I've just never had any desire to... The pinball song. Tommy, that's what it's called, Tommy. You're a pinball wizard. I think that might be lyrics. I don't even know. Go Tommy, go! With, you know, all those classic lines from the Tommy song. Yeah, I know nothing about The Who. I just never a band anybody in my life has ever listened to. I've never had any desire. I've knew I would never like Led Zeppelin, but I at least gave that a shot. But The Who was just something like just never really got into it outside of the Tommy. And I decided, hey, I think this Lucero might be a chore. I'm going to pick something a little easy to listen to that people will gasp that I never listened to. Unfortunately, I think I should have did a little more research because I really did just go, what's the best Who record into Google? And a bunch of sources said, Who's Next? Mm-hmm. And as Scott warned me, I think the Who has had like a 75-year career.
Yeah.
So maybe I should have looked for something more that I thought would be my speed, because I just always assumed that the Who were just a British rock band that just sounded like British rock music and didn't sound like they're fucking Lynyrd Skynyrd or whatever the fuck they're playing on this, because it's like a lot of like Southern rock influence on this, and I wasn't expecting that. And it took me like a few listens for me to go from, man, this record's bullshit, to like anything respectable, like any kind of respectable opinion on this record. I purposely didn't read up on this record because it's such like a, you know, it's such a band that allegedly everybody knows about. And I was like, if this is this classic band's classic record, I want it to speak to me. I don't want to read about it. I want me to be like, oh, I understand why this is a classic record. And I never really got to that point. But I've come up with some theories why it might be a classic record. First of all, it was released in 1971, and like there was only like three kinds of rock music back then. And so I think they do a good job of taking all three of those kinds of rock music and making, you know, a pretty comprehensive record out of those three kinds of rock music. So I get it. I'm assuming fucking 50 years ago, that was like a crazy thing to do. To just be like, oh, we're going to take like kind of British rock and Southern rock and this kind of like ballady, you know, power ballad stuff. I don't even know what it was called back then, but and kind of just like put it all together, a little poppy. And we're going to make like this kind of like sort of epic music for the time. This sounds pretty epic. This is a whole record just like Jethro Tull where I'm just like, can we resubmit this record as far as classic records go and maybe reevaluate it? Because I don't know. I mean, maybe it has the bones of what a million other bands would do afterwards, and that's why it's so classic. But listening to it the first time in 2019, I'm not like, this is essential. So, you know, again, whatever. But as, you know, a little more specific, though, the first song is called Baba O'Reilly, which is the other Who song I know, of course, because I know this song is Teenage Wasteland. I never knew this song was called Baba O'Reilly. Isn't that a Beatles song? Am I making that up?
I don't know, but when I was a kid and I told my mom that this song was named Baba O'Reilly, she didn't believe me. She's like, no, it's not. It's Teenage. So it was never common knowledge, even to the target demographic.
Yeah. So the song's called Baba O'Reilly.
Maybe you're thinking of Obladi Oblada.
Yeah, what's that called?
That's Obladi.
Does he say Baba O'Reilly in his...
No, he says Obladi Oblada.
Does he say Baba O'Reilly?
I don't think so.
There's a song they have where they... they mentioned somebody named O'Reilly or something. I don't fucking know.
Eleanor Rigby?
Maybe.
Baba O'Reilly lives in the...
that's exactly how that song goes. Yeah, we're going to have to... That's another All Holes filled. Yeah. So that song, again, that's the one Who song besides the pinball song that everybody knows. It's the one that goes... and then it goes, Teenage Wasteland. And everybody knows this song.
Yeah.
What I did not know is this song is fucking 5 minutes long in its original version. And here's a hot take. This song sounds much better when they use it in soundtracks and they cut it down to fucking 3 minutes and it just goes from that cool intro to the chorus and then the song ends. Because there's a lot of dicking around after this that's just like, fuck. Well, the song's still going on for 2 more minutes. They're just doing nonsense. But again, at the time, I think it sounds pretty epic. That's why I'm thinking this is a classic record. I'm thinking no one was doing this in 1971. These guys are making these kind of, you know, like compositions. It's beyond songs. They're making like actual compositions with rock music. And that's probably pretty impressive in 1971. 2019, not so much. Then they're going to like a couple more Southern rock songs. There's a song called My Wife, and that's pretty cool. my favorite song on this record is the 6-minute and 14-second Behemoth. The song is over. This is right smack dab, 6 minute song, smack dab in your record. But this song's really good. This is a keeper from this record for me. It's mostly piano fronted, and it's kind of like a ballad, but this song really stuck with me. I think this is the hit. This is the Who. This is the song that's gonna get you to those heights. Is the song is over. I don't know if other people feel this way, but if you are a Who head, let me know where the song is over ranks in your Who head rankings. There's another song on here called "Going Mobile," which I have to imagine when cell phones hit England. This song must have been licensed instantly for a commercial. Like, that's the only thing I can think of. Again, Anglophiles out there. For another one for the Anglophiles is let me know what cell phone provider out there used the Going Mobile song, because it's got to be somebody out there. Outside of that, this version on Spotify is like some essential comprehensive... I don't even know version that has 700 tracks on it, and they're all taken from different sources. And I only listen to the track list that's on Wikipedia, and I didn't listen to anything after that. So I don't know if anything changed, but as far as this version that I listened to, it's decent. It's not my thing. I don't think I have any desire to listen to any more Who songs. I'm gonna probably forget most of this outside of the Teenage Wasteland and the song is over. After, you know, a week from now, I'll forget I ever listened to any of this. But like I said, if the my theories for why this is a classic record, if that is actually true, I understand. If it's just because people think this is like the greatest songs they've ever written, then I don't know. But I don't think I want to hear any more if that's the case. But it's fine for fucking a 50 year old record. It's pretty decent, but it's just not my shit in the end. But Scott, I think you're a little more experienced. So what do you think?
I don't know where to go with this because your scorched earth review is like, I didn't have a counterpoint ready. I never thought it would be this burning hot in here that I thought everybody liked the Who. I thought this would be a slam dunk for just about anybody, but here we are. Mike, you don't like the CSI theme song or I don't know where to go with that. So the Southern rock thing, you're right. I guess you're totally right about that, but I never think about it because I hear like the synths and I hear like the epics, you know, like I've been listening to this since I was a kid, so I don't even think about it. But there is a lot, you know, there's definitely a lot, and more so than you imagine, because there's, you know, I'll kind of get into this a little bit later, but, you know, British bands in general liked fucking with genres and doing like, you know, Tin Pan Alley songs and like, you know, these guys definitely, they do some jug band music, for real.
Yeah.
But so, you know, something you want to avoid if you ever find yourself in a band is allowing the concept album dude to get too far ahead of himself. Just take a few minutes out of your day right now and see if you, I'm sure it's on YouTube because they all are, but watch the behind the music about Styx. This is a band where they.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember that was the, like, I remember watching that when I was a kid and or when I was a teen, and I was like, Man, this makes Styx sound so interesting to me. I never went and listened to him. I got to put them on the list now. I got
to
do it.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that one because I want to guide you to a better choice than where you're probably going to go. But this is a band that they let the theater geek run amok to their great disfavor. It tanked them. Once your guy is showing up to practice, telling you which outfits and costumes you're going to wear for which songs, and you're still playing in punk houses and basements, you should just quit that band because this guy, he's going to fuck you. But that's Pete Townshend, the guitarist of The Who. He got away with it because Tommy was weird. It was a weird idea. Have you ever seen the movie?
So this is after Tommy?
This is after Tommy, which is surprising. It won't be surprising when I reveal the secret.
I would have never guessed that. Yeah. Okay.
When I reveal the secret of who's next to you, you won't be surprised. So, yeah, Tommy is... Did you ever see Tommy? Did you ever see the movie?
I've only seen clips. I never watched the whole thing, no.
You know, it's a pretty weird idea. It's about, like, a deaf, dumb, and blind pinball wizard, obviously. And he got Tina Turner and Elton John. That's a couple of pretty good gets. So he floated that. And then later on, I think after this, he does Quadrophenia, which is also weird, but it's like topical at the time. It's about mods and stuff. And, you know, The Who were mods. They were like, they've had at least three careers because they were the top of the heap for mod rockers. They were like the defining mod band in the 60s. Then they were whatever the hell this is in the 70s, you know, this like arena rock powerhouse. And then they actually had a very brief dalliance with like 80s synth pop that didn't totally go very well. And, you know, on the topic of what you said about the 5-minute song, this is something like our friend Hans posted that, because he does sound now, and he posted that some band was doing a jam cover of the song Eminence Front as though that was crazy. And I was like, dude, Eminence Front is 2 minutes of synths and guitar solos before the first lyric is sung. 2 minutes. It's a pop song that was on the radio, and there is 2 minutes of dicking around before the first lyric comes out. And then they stop and go into another guitar solo for a while. So The Who were about that 5-minute thing. That's their shit. He was into the concept album thing. And he was really trying to do that with this. This was supposed to be a concept album called Lifehouse. And this would have been the one where you get to smack the member of your band for suggesting it. You get maybe even beat him to death. Because... This was supposed to be a rock opera about a dystopian future where rock music is banned and one man fights back by finding like a guitar or some records or starting a ham radio station. There's 60 albums out there like this, including Mr. Roboto. Like this is basically like starting your story out with It's a Dark and Stormy Night. It's the worst concept album that you can come up with conceptually. It's a total mess. But luckily they bailed on the concept. Whatever happened, I don't know, it just didn't pan out for them, but they still had to put out an album, so they kind of pieced it together. You could still hear it, though. The song that you mentioned, The Song Is Over, the beginning part of that is very clearly, like, setting up some character, like, what's going on with me? What's happening to me? You know, it's like Broadway musical shit. It's a fiasco. But then luckily, you know, Roger Daltrey, the real singer, barges in drunk, like, fuck that, let's do a different song, and he just starts singing, like, the good part, and just bellows something way better over it. And so the other thing that I mentioned that's a little bit off about The Who, you could take or leave, you know, people could take or leave this. Some of these songs are pretty good, but they're a 60s, 70s British rock band. All those guys, the Beatles, the Kinks, even up to Queen, they like to do like jug band songs and like the like they like to do those goofy songs. And, The Who had Mama's Got a Squeeze Box. They had goofy novelty songs like Boris the Spider, Happy Jack. They just you probably haven't heard these songs, Mike, but they're silly. They're fun, but they're silly. And blessedly for you, there's not a whole lot of that on this album. I think the closest they get is Love Ain't for Keeping, which is kind of, that's probably why it feels so Skinner-y, because this is definitely one.
Yeah.
I think it stands out because it's the only one that's not like a weird futuristic folk rock song or like Going Mobile, you know, or like a massive arena song or something. I think My Wife is kind of a novelty. My Wife is kind of a novelty. And that's probably because the bassist wrote it. That sounds about right. But it has these like goofy little horn stabs. Like once the song kind of starts moving towards the end, these little beep, 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 these little horn stabs come out. And they're awesome. I love them. I don't know if synths could do that at the time and the keyboard is doing this, or if they actually brought in some very unlucky horn players to just like this session. I love it. I think it's sweet. You know, so I mean, like I'm a fan. I like the Who. I personally think the Who is the best, the most satisfying band from this era. They're like a Voltron band because the drummer is this crazy like animal from the Muppets guy, and he's really good. Like he's all fill. He's like the master. He's like the guy from Mastodon. He's just all fills. You know, he's always doing stuff. And they had this like dandy shred lord bassist who wore dozens of rings, and played bass solos when no one was allowed to play bass solos. And they had Pete Townshend, you know, who was doing the swinging your arm thing and the smashing guitars thing, kind of invented that thing, probably because he was the least handsome dude in the band and had to act up, you know, like nobody was really looking at him. So he's like, check me out, and smash his guitar. And they had the singer who is what you would draw if I said draw a lead singer. He's like this golden statue of a guy with like long, crazy hair who has like these giant leathery lungs and could just shout for a half hour through an entire set. I'm surprised this isn't your favorite album now after listening to it once. I thought this was a guaranteed spin. I would have placed money on it because this is definitely like one of the.
I don't completely hate it. It's just, yeah. I don't know. It's for something that's been built up as like this classic thing to me. I was expecting, yeah, you know, to just be floored. And it's kind of weird that you would say that this is a forgotten, busted like concept album, and this would be their most popular album, because that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's wall-to-wall jams, but you know, whether you know it or not, this is probably the only record that your mom owned, or your maybe your grandmom owned, that had piss on the cover. Only love can make it rain like the sweat of lovers laying in the fields. Yeah.